I'm glad you could come tonight, and I hope you can stay after the reading to meet Mr. Matheson, have some refreshments in the hall just outside. Our next reading will be 1 week from tonight, visiting poet Denise Levertov. And 2 weeks from tonight, our final visiting poet for the year, Henry Carlyle. Both of those readings will be in this room. I promised Mr. Matheson I would not give his entire life history, and I'm not going to read the names of all of his books. He has published 5 novels, among them Far Tortuga and At Play in the Fields of the Lord, and 11 books of nonfiction. The most recent one, In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, was not admired by everyone. He has $49 million in lawsuits pending. The Snow Leopard, which in 1979 won the National Book Award. And his most recent book will appear next month. It's called Indian Country. It's being published by Viking Press. Dee Brown, the author of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, in a review in this month's Natural History magazine, says, "If Indian Country reaches the audience that it merits, it could have an impact comparable to that of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring 20 years ago." It's my great pleasure to introduce Peter Matheson.
Embarrassing to go around with a big bag full of your own books, but can't be helped tonight. First, I wanted to thank Lois for a very generous introduction, and thank you all for being here tonight. It's kind of hot here. Have you all seen my jacket? Various people wanted to hear from various books, and I've decided on 3. I'm going to read first from a book called The Snow Leopard, and then from the new book, Indian Country, both rather briefly, and then I'm going to try an experiment, which may not work, and I reserve the option of abandoning that in mid-flight, retreating to something safer. It's an hallucination scene, and but I'll talk a little bit more about that before I start. And very briefly, The Snow Leopard is about a trip to a place called the Crystal Monastery and on the Tibetan Plateau, and a very remote place where the animals were protected, where this biologist, George Schaller, and I had hopes of seeing animals behaving and interreacting in a totally natural way. Is this mic clear in the back of the room? Can you all hear? Okay. And because the Lama, the Tibetan Buddhist Lama of this region, of the Crystal Monastery, had forbidden all killing in the area. So these animals were apparently, by report, were behaving in a totally natural way. And we had to walk 250 miles to get there. It was across the Himalaya and way up onto the border of Tibet. But it was a wonderful and beautiful walk. I had a few problems with, you know, narrow mountain ledges and things, but it was great. And this is just a passage from the very beginning when we're setting off from a town called Pokhara in west central Nepal. "We are glad to go. These edges of Pokhara might be tropical outskirts anywhere. Vacant children, listless adults, bent dogs and thin chickens, and litter of sagging shacks and rubble, mud, weeds, stagnant ditches, bad sweet smells, vivid bright broken plastic bits, and dirty fruit peelings awaiting the carrion pig. For want of better fare, both pigs and dogs consume the human excrement that lies everywhere along the paths. In fair weather, all this flux is tolerable, But now, at the drag end of the rainy season, the mire of life seems leached into the sallow skins of these thin beings, who squat and soak themselves and wring their clothes each morning in the rain puddles. Brown eyes observe us as we pass. Confronted with the pain of Asia, one cannot look and cannot turn away. In India, human misery seems so pervasive that one takes in only stray details, a warped leg or a dead eye, a sick pariah dog eating withered grass, an ancient woman lifting her sari to move her shrunken bowels by the road. Yet in Varanasi, there is hope of life that has been abandoned in such cities as Calcutta, which seems resigned to the dead and dying in its gutters. Shiva dances in the spicy foods, in the exhilarated bells of the swarming bicycles, the angry bus horns, the chatter of the temple monkeys, the vermilion tikka dot on the women's foreheads, even in the scent of charred human flesh that pervades the ghats. The people smile. That is the greatest miracle of all. In the heat and stench and shriek of Varanasi, wherein fiery sunrise swallows fly like departing spirits over the vast silent river, one delights in the smile of a blind girl being led, of a Hindu gentleman in white turban gazing benignly at the bus driver who reviles him, of a flute-playing beggar boy, of a slow old woman pouring holy water from Ganga, the river, onto a stone elephant daubed red. Near the burning ghats and the industry of death, a river palace has been painted with huge, candy-striped tigers. No doubt Varanasi is the destination of this ancient Hindu at the outskirts of Pokhara, propped up on a basket borne on poles across the shoulders of four servants, off it appears on his last pilgrimage to the Mother Ganges, to the dark temples that surround the ghats, to those hostels where the pilgrim waits his turn to join the company of white-shrouded cadavers by the river edge, waits again to be laid upon the stacks of fired wood. The attendants will push this yellow foot, that shriveled elbow, back into the fire, and rake his remains off the burning platform into the swift river. And still enough scraps will remain to sustain life in the long-headed, cadaverous dogs that haunt the ashes, while sacred kine, huge white silent things, devour the straw thongs that had bound this worn-out body to its stretcher. The old man has been ravined from within. That blind and greedy stare of his, that caved-in look, and the mouth working, reveal who now inhabits him, who now stares out. I nod to death in passing, aware of the sound of my own feet upon my path. The ancient is lost in a shadow world and gives no sign. We walked along for several weeks westward, and then we're starting northward over the Himalaya, and we came to a Middle Ages town called Tarakot. Tarakot in the kingdom of Tichurong, wonderful old kingdom there called Tichurong. We arrived there in the middle of the afternoon. Tarakot is in twilight shadow by mid-afternoon, while the mountainside across the Berry River facing south lies in full sunshine. In strong dusk, the women gather up the grain in homespun sacks to store inside. Now the snow peaks take on color, and whistling boys bring kine and sheep and goats from the high pasture. A rooster and a barking dog, the sting of sticks on the hard flanks of the cattle, the cry of the village termagant unceasing, is the voice of autumn twilight in every peasant village across time. For a while on the roof, I watch the coming of the night. A bat chitters and stars loom, and somewhere on the far side of this earth, the sun is burning. Soon Mars appears over the dark split in the northern mountains where the Tarap River comes down from the land of Dolpo. And in the snug warmth of my sleeping bag, I float under the round bowl of the heavens. Above is the glistening galaxy of childhood, now hidden in the Western world by air pollution and the glare of artificial light. For my children's children, the power, peace, and healing of the night will be obliterated. Every little while I wake and watch the spiral of the heavens. Orion rises and the Pleiades. Shooting stars arc in the shimmering void of the black universe, and toward four, the sky is parted by a satellite, mercifully silent, like a probe from another world, a distant century. A horse screams. The moon is up over Tibet, and in the southern mountains over Jiang, the planet Mars is disappearing. How much dignity the moon has lost, now that man has left his disrespectful litter his cute golf balls. But the moon retains its mystery for the dogs that teach you wrong, which howl in awe at its first appearance and set one another off the whole night through. While its fellows rest, the dog next door harangues the cosmos for an hour. The mastiffs sleep much of the day and are let loose at night to deal with wolves and robbers. In the absence of such, they will make do with strangers. Not caring to venture out into the streets when such brutes are abroad, I follow the custom of the town, standing on the roof edge and urinating into the mud street in daybreak light. We've arrived at the Crystal Mountain safely after a number of weeks and are studying the blue sheep there, and have found a lot of sign of snow leopard in the area, and have also seen at very close range these absolutely superb wolves, which, like the sheep, are very tame and just look over their shoulder and walk away. They don't run when you come up to them. The place really was as advertised. It was extraordinary how tame everything was there. And I'm going up this particular day to meditate and also to watch for the snow leopard. After 2 hours of hard climbing, our camp was at 14,000 feet where we were staying, and then we would climb up on these higher mountains around for observation. After 2 hours of hard climbing, I am higher than Black Pond, and the whole canyon of the Black River, ascending toward the Kang Pass, lies exposed to view. Beyond the Kang soars a resplendent wall of white that dominates the sky to the southwest. It is the great ice wall of Kanjiroba, a rampart of crystalline escarpments and white-winged cornices well over 20,000 feet in height. Here there is only a light air from the east, but the high wind on Kanjiroba is blowing clouds of fine snow from points and pinnacles that turn into transparency against the blue. These days are luminous, as in those far October days in Teach You Wrong. There is no wisp of cloud, clear, 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 clear. Although the shade is very cold throughout the day and wind persists, the sun is hot. Imagine a striped and shiny lizard above 15,000 feet in deep November. For the first time in my life, I apprehend the pure heat of our star, piercing the frigid atmospheres of so many million miles of outer space. Rock and snow peaks all around, the sky and great birds and black rivers. What words are there to seize such ringing splendor? But again, something arises in this ringing that is not quite bearable, a poised terror, as in the diamond ice that cracks the stone. The brain veers, the sun glints like a weapon. Then Black Canyon writhes and twists, and the Crystal Mountain looms as a castle of dread, and all the universe reverberates with horror. My head is the sorcerer's skull cup full of blood, and were I to turn, my eyes would see straight to the heart of chaos, the mutilation, bloody gore, and pain that is seen darkly in the bright eye of this lizard. Then lunacy is gone, leaving an echo. The lizard is still there, one with its rock, flanks pulsing in the star heat that brings warmth to our common skin. Eternity is not remote, it is here beside us. I grow into these mountains like a moss. I am bewitched. The blinding snow peaks and the clarion air, the sound of earth and heaven in the silence, the requiem birds, the mythic beasts, the flags, great horns, and old carved stones, the rough-hewn Tartars in their braids and homespun boots, the silver ice in the Black River, the Kang, the Crystal Mountain. Also, I love the common miracles, the murmur of my friends at evening, the clay fires of smudgy juniper, the coarse, dull food, the hardship and simplicity, the contentment of doing one thing at a time. When I take my blue tin cup into my hand, that is all I do. We've had no news of modern times since late September, and we'll have none until December, and gradually my mind has cleared itself, and wind and sun pour through my head as through a bell. Though we talk little here, I am never lonely. I am returned into myself. Having got here at last, I do not wish to leave the Crystal Mountain. I am in pain about it, truly, so much so that I have to smile or I might weep. In another life, this isn't what I know, but how I feel. These mountains were my home. There is a rising of forgotten knowledge like a spring from hidden aquifers under the earth. To glimpse one's own true nature is a kind of homegoing to a place east of the sun, west of the moon. The homegoing that needs no home, like that waterfall on the upper Suligad that turns to mist before touching the earth and rises once again into the sky. Now, we've been there for most of a month, and I'm getting ready to leave there. I left without Schaller. I went out with two Sherpas on my own and went by a different route. And I did a kind of a queer thing, which offended my partner there. We had sent a few Sherpas away about halfway through the trip because we were running out of food, and we had to conserve. So we sent them back to the nearest settlement where there was some hope of getting some mail, and indeed they brought some mail back to our astonishment. And I had an instinct not to open my mail, even though I was feeling very guilty about having left my kids at home and my wife had just died, and I was a little bit uneasy about it. At the same time, I knew I couldn't leave there until a certain time. I didn't want to intrude upon that experience with bad news from home, which would worry me since I couldn't do anything about it anyway. So I simply put my letters away. And Schaller was quite surprised by that. He still talks about it. I prepare to go, though I try hard to remain. The part of me that is bothered by the unopened letters in my rucksack, that longs to see my children, to drink wine, make love, be clean and comfortable again, that part is already facing south over the mountains. This makes me sad, and so I stare about me, trying to etch into this journal the sense of Shea that is so precious, aware that all such effort is in vain. The beauty of this place must be cheerfully abandoned, like the wild rocks and the bright water of its streams. Frustration at the paltriness of words drives me to write, but there is more of Shea in a single sheep hair and one withered sprig of everlasting than in all these notes. To strive for permanence in what I think I have perceived is to miss the point. Near my lookout, I find a place to meditate out of the wind, a hollow on the ridge where snow has melted. My brain soon clears in the cold mountain air, and I feel better. Wind blowing grasses sun. The dying grass, the notes of southbound birds in the mountain sky, are no more fleeting than the rock itself, no more so, and no less. All is the same. The mountain withdraws into its stillness, my body dissolves into the sunlight, tears fall that have nothing to do with I. What it is that brings them on, I do not know. In other days, I understood mountains differently, seeing in them something that abides. Even when approached respectfully, they appalled me with their permanence, with that awful and irrefutable rockness that seemed to intensify my sense of my own transience. And perhaps this dread of transience explains our greed for the few gobbets of raw experience in modern life. Why violence is libidinous, why lust devours us, why soldiers choose not to forget their days of horror. We cling to such extreme moments in which we seem to die, yet are reborn. In sexual abandon, as in danger, we are impelled, however briefly, into that vital present in which we do not stand apart from life. We are life. Our being fills us. In ecstasy with another being, loneliness falls away into eternity. But in other days, such union was attainable through simple awe. My foot slips on a narrow ledge. In that split second, as needles of fear pierce heart and temple, eternity intersects with present time. Thought and action are not different, and stone, air, ice, sun, fear, and self are one. What is exhilarating is to extend this acute awareness into ordinary moments in the moment-by-moment experiencing of the lammergeier and the wolf, which, finding themselves at the center of things, have no need for any secret of true being. In this very breath that we take now lies a secret that all great teachers try to tell us, what one Lama refers to as the precision and openness and intelligence of the present moment. The purpose of meditation practice is not enlightenment. It is to pay attention even at unextraordinary times, to be of the present, nothing but the present, to bear this mindfulness of now into each event of ordinary life. When I watch blue sheep, I must watch blue sheep, not be thinking about sex, danger, or the present, for this present, even while I think of it, is gone. That's probably enough for the snow leopard. I'm sorry, I seem to have chosen rather serious passages there, and actually we had a lot of fun on the trip too. And the selection kind of winnowed down in a way I wouldn't have to remember that. This is the galley proofs of Indian Country, which is coming out in about a month. And it's been called a sequel to my Indian book that came out last year called In the Spirit of Crazy Horse. It's not really a sequel. It was really mostly written before In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, beginning about 1975. And parts of it have appeared in a number of magazines and Sunday newspapers around the country. I'll read first from this is one of the few success stories of about 12 chapters in this book. Most of them ended badly. In almost all cases, Indian land was encroached upon and finally taken and or spoiled by corporate interests or the federal bureaucracy working with corporate interests. But in this particular case, we seem to have won at least a temporary victory. It's a thing called the Go Road in Northern California. Some of you may know about it. It goes from Orleans on the Klamath River to Gasquet, a little bit further north. It's a great big superhighway that parallels the Coast Road through over these high, dry ridges. It's hidden at both ends. The Forest Service went in about 4 or 5 miles at one end and 7 miles on the other end before starting the highway, apparently to disguise it from the public who are going to be paying for it. There's no reason for this road at all. It's not a tourist area. It goes right across the sacred area of three different Indian groups, plows right through there. At least it's trying to, and we're trying to stop it. There's one unfinished section of about 7.5 miles that so far has been held up in court, and it now looks like it's going to be held up semi-permanently. The only reason for this road is one Indian says it's a glorified logging road to save yet more money for the big corporations that don't need that money. But anyway, so before we knew this victory had happened, I wanted to see the sacred area and approach it the way it had been approached by traditional people who were in medicine training, who climb up this wonderful Blue Creek drainage and then up these ridges to what's called Dr. Rock, where they went for medicine training. And they had a kind of a 4-day vision quest fasting arrangement there, rather like a Great Plains vision quest, but not quite. It's a little bit more complex than that. And I had two Indian friends, a young Yurok guy and his stepfather, who was a Cherokee, John Troll, and we just camped on the Blue Creek drainage and then climbed up to this place. And this is just a passage from that chapter. We'd gone up there in a very mysterious way because we hadn't made proper preparations. We couldn't get near the rock, even though it was right there in plain sight. We couldn't approach it. There's always a gully in the way, and suddenly we were past it. And I'd been told this would happen up there, and in fact, I'd been up there the year before with other Indian friends, and the same thing had happened. This place was holding us off like a magnet. It was very mysterious and kind of great. But we were exhausted. We climbed up all day long, and we couldn't beat the system up there. So we went back to where our camp was in this very pretty meadow, and a lot of bears and stuff. It's an extraordinary area. This is the Siskiyou Mountains. A great many rare plants there. It seems to be botanically connected to Asia in some strange way. There are many plant groups that are actually Asian in origin, and many strange conifers that occur nowhere else, and also quite a few rare creatures which are rare everywhere, like the spotted owl and the wolverine and cougar and things like that. Long before dark in the endless summer evening, we were fast asleep, and we slept hard until first light. Even then, after 10 hours' rest, it was difficult to bring John back to life. "Come on, Grandfather," Dick said in his gentle voice. It was important to leave before the sun was high in order to bushwhack down through that hard scrub to the cool forest on the ridge. We set off at daybreak without breakfast, and once underway we made good time, rounding the mountain and traversing the steep barren slopes that led down into thick undergrowth, pausing just once to gaze at the lovely sunrise worlds below. During the night, the ocean fogs had rolled into the Klamath Gorge, pushing thick white tentacles into the canyons of Blue Creek, leaving the ridges all around like green islands in a sea of clouds. This silent world lay far below the rock, where we sat perched like three unshaven angels. And seeing the white river flowing in from the white ocean, I understood much better the Yurok concept of the world as a kind of disk bisected by the Klamath, rising and falling minutely on the surrounding sea. John Troll frowned and cleared his throat. "You're very close to heaven here," he muttered. He glared at us as if daring us to laugh. Then he spoke about a time up in the mountain when he had found himself quite suddenly in a beautiful, strange place where he had never been before, and yet which seemed somehow familiar, as if remembered from another life. He had walked along as if entranced, weeping and laughing simultaneously, as if on the point of remembering something that would bring him instantly and forever a profound understanding of the world, of life and death. Bewildered and uncomfortable, he stopped speaking, and for a little while we sat in silence on the mountainside. And it occurred to me that what John had described was the world which the aspirin Indians of other days who had come up these steps into the high country had wished to enter. In the words of an old Indian lady down at Requa, where the Klamath rolls out between huge sandbars, rocks, and cliffs into the sea, "You come upon a place you've never seen before, and it has awesome beauty. Everything about you, above you, below you, around you is so pure. That is the beauty we call Mewaksega, and the pure person is also Mewaksega." John Troll was embarrassed by the suggestion that what he had had was a mystical experience. Such experience, he had always thought, was strong evidence of a weak mind. Sighing, he stood up and set his pack, wondering aloud if his old shoes would get him home. We moved rapidly downhill into Blue Creek, swinging easily along through the old forest and arriving at the river edge well before noon. At camp, we made a scavenger's meal of what had been left behind, bran flakes, raw potato, chunks of jarred venison, and kept on going, pausing to swim in a deep hole at the first bend, fording, refording, and fording again, pausing to gather a mouthful of wild strawberries, going on. This next passage is about a man named Chief Buster McCurdy, who in the 60s was a very, very well-known Indian leader, a brave man, who's now, like many of these leaders of that time, has been kind of isolated and cut off, and is out of touch with even with his own people, who've been kind of co-opted by the tribal councils and Bureau of Indian Affairs. And he lives alone on a beautiful farm, actually, that he's built for his sister. He's no longer has a wife. This guy I was traveling with had worked with Buster and many other people. We made a kind of a trip all around the back country in the back roads of the Great Basin and the Northern California and down into New Mexico and Arizona too. And he was looking up these people to see how many were left and who was still, as they say, standing on the land. In other words, holding to traditional way of life. At the Utah border, a road heads south along the west edge of the Great Salt Desert, a waste of white alkali flats and old dead lakes, stretching away between far small archipelagos of dry mountains. At each turn off, the road diminishes, tending east into the remote Ibapa Valley, where good water comes down from the steep ridges of the Deep Creek Range into an ancient territory of the Gosi Ute. Near the south end of the valley, where the land is green and there is forest on the steep valley walls, a dirt lane turns off past a well-made garden, meandering uphill to a large farmhouse set about with weathered sheds built out of logs. Craig said he had enemies on this reservation. Not sure of the reception we might get, he told me to park the truck for a quick getaway. While I listened to the bells of the homecoming sheep and the howls of a retarded boy who was wandering here and there behind the farmhouse, Craig got out and talked for a long time in the cool spring twilight with a stocky, guarded man in khaki shirt and coveralls who came out to meet him. Eventually, they came over to the truck, and because it was cold, we sat in the front seat like churchgoers, gazing northward up the valley toward High Pilot Peak. "This is Chief Buster McCurdy," Craig said after a while. "Chief," Buster McCurdy exclaimed, still a little bewildered by our visit. Like most of the people we had gone to, he had not seen Craig since 1969. As if not sure what we might want, he sat motionless and quiet for a while, thick, heavy hands square on his knees, a surprised expression on his face. Ute is the real name of his people, their own name, that is, for the Indians, the people. And Ute-ah, or Utah, he explained, just means them Indians over there. Gosi Ute, or Goshute, "That's Dusty Ute," he said, "because we'd be going along all covered with desert dust on the way to the meeting grounds over in Provo Valley, where we wintered sometimes with Paiute and Shoshone." These days, the few hundred Gosha Ute were divided between this band and another across the mountains in Skull Valley. "Ute and Paiute understand each other pretty good," Buster said, "but we don't understand much Shoshone language, just a few words to get by. The books say we're all the same bunch, but we ain't." Buster McCurdy was raised here in Abapa, but he married a Ute woman from the Hiawintas and lived over in the east part of the state for many years as a hard-working and very successful mechanic. In the late 50s and early 60s, his auto repair work had supported the journeys on Indian business made by his wife, Etta McCurdy, and other traditional spokesmen. Buster himself, one respect, is a courageous and outspoken leader, and was jailed more than once for his beliefs. Among real Indians, Craig told me, Buster McCurdy was a hero from coast to coast. Most of the traditionals here in the Abapa Valley have died out, and Buster McCurdy has been threatened more than once by armed BIA Indians. There's nobody on our side. We've got nobody to turn to. A girl he had mentioned as his potential successor as a leader here had died from too much liquor. They discussed the northern Utes up in Uinta, one-fourth of whom died from alcohol-related diseases or accidents in the year after liquor sales to Indians were legalized in 1952 as part of the termination program. And Buster, those Gosha Utes over in Skull Valley, he said, those poor people are shot. That tribal council guy they have has driven them right down the drain. They're going to have their pinon trees, their deer hunting grounds, all taken away from them because all they can see is dollar signs. Liquor is the main trouble here, too, and it's going to be a dead place pretty soon. I told them that, but they won't listen. He sighed. I kind of give up now. Just flare up once in a while is all. The night before, Buster had led us to a hill pasture beyond his sister's house, where one of the two streams coveted by the white ranchers comes down the steep mountainside from the high evergreen in a ribbon of poplar, willow, and red birch. At daybreak, he came to sit on his heels at our campfire, and we spent a long, slow, peaceful morning in the sun while Craig cooked us up some of his mush. I never thought I'd see Craig again, he told me when Craig had gone up to the stream to wash. We had some fun, all right, in those days. Recently, McCurdy had a dream that didn't feel like any dream. It was a vision. I saw Salt Lake City, all them nice buildings, smoke was coming out, and some were ruined, and there were no people. There was nobody around. The man with me said it must have been an earthquake. But I didn't think so. It was something else. Before leaving, we filled our bottles with good mountain water and complimented Buster on how well the farm looked. We offered him a lift back down the hillside to the farm, and he shook his head. Might as well walk, he said. I'll see you again, Craig said, taking his hand. Buster McCurdy held Craig's hand for a long time, looking him over. I don't know when, he said at last. Looking back at the still figure on the mountainside as the truck rolled down the slope in the spring ruts, I remembered a moment the afternoon before when Craig had asked him how many people here at Abapa were still standing on the land, and Chief Buster McCurdy, saying nothing, had raised up a solitary finger. Okay, I better, if I'm going to do playing the Fields of the Lord, I better get to it. Playing the Fields of the Lord is a novel, and its hero is a mixed-blood Cheyenne Indian, a guy called Lewis Moon. He's a rather, well, I don't know how to describe him. Interesting figure, I guess, I hope. And he has kind of run away from his past. He's run away from the reservation. He's won a scholarship to college, and he blows it through drinking, getting in fights. The alumni don't want an Indian in this college, so they come to him, they try to bribe him to get drunk and create a scene on the campus and so forth. And he agrees to do it, really sort of cynicism and drunkenness, and then beats these two guys up and steals their car. And then he heads east because he's got to leave the state. And so he's now, in this book, he's begun a long life of wandering. I didn't want to get too much into Moon's background, first because I can't claim I'm qualified to speak about it that much, and second because this novel takes place in South America where he has now ended up after many years of wandering as a kind of a soldier of fortune. And But he's still hung up on this thing. He's still hung up on Indian way, on trying to perceive the true Indian traditional existence. And in the course of this, he takes this book, he takes a drug called ayahuasca. It's Banisteriopsis copy. It's a very, very strong phenol alkaloid related to LSD and mescaline, but a good deal stronger. I've taken it. It's a very powerful, morbid experience. And this chapter I'm about to read, I'm not reading it all, but excerpts from, is his hallucination. It was my device as a writer. I needed a way to evoke Moon's past without going into a kind of a long, detailed history of where he came from and who he was. And so what comes up in this trip that I describe here is their memories of his college experience, of the sheriff, the local sheriff who was trying to bait him into making a mistake, of the episode where he steals the car, and memories of his mother, Big Irma, and his father, and so forth, then coming back into the present again. So you kind of have to bear with me, the dreams and references, and just try to pay attention closely if you can, and I will make it as clear as I can. He's lying on a bed in a real ratty South American river hotel, and he's just taken this, he's just about to start. Here he goes. A dog turned in its circle and lay down in the shade, and a vulture swung up and down in a short arc above the jungle as if suspended from a string. In the heat of the siesta, the street below was hollow as a bone. He took the cork out of the bottle and, holding his breath to kill the bitterness, drank off half the brown fluid in a series of short gulps, gargling harshly when he was finished and spitting the residue into the street. The aftertaste made him gag. He sat down on the windowsill, and in a little while the nausea receded, leaving only a thick woody taste and a slight vagueness. A half hour passed. Maybe the Indian had watered the infusion. A voice in the saloon below sounded remote to him, and he nodded. He was on his way. A little more ayahuasca, Mr. Moon? He took up the bottle and drank off another quarter of it, and set it down very slowly. You've made a bad mistake, he thought. Already he knew he did not need it. The effects were coming very suddenly, and he stood up and stalked the room. An overdose, he had read somewhere, the extract of Banisteriopsis copy is quite poisonous and may bring on convulsions, shock, and even death. How silent it was. The whole world was in siesta. He glanced quickly out the window to take time by surprise. The dog slept soundly, and the vulture still swung up and down its bit of sky, dark as a pendulum. From the far end of the street, a solitary figure was moving toward him, down the center of the street. The last man on earth. There you are, he thought. I've been waiting for you all my life. Now he was seized with vertigo and apprehension. His heart began to pound and his breath was short. He went to his bed and lay down on his back. There was a closure of the throat and a tension in his chest, a metal bar from chin to navel to which the skin of his chest was sewn. Breathing became still more difficult, and a slight pain in the back of his head became a general diffused headache. He turned cold and his teeth chattered. The hands pressed to his face were limp and clammy. I am flying all apart, he thought. At the same time, his chest constricted ever more tightly. Let go, he told himself aloud, let go. He rolled over on his side and blinked at the other bed. Color, the room billowed with it. The room breathed. When he closed his eyes, the color dazzled him. He soared, but there was trouble in his lungs again, and his heart thumped so in heavy spasmodic leaps that it must surely stall and die. He broke into a sweat, and his hands turned cold as small bags of wet sand. He sat up aching in a foreign room. He could breathe again, although his heart still hurled itself unmercifully against his chest. How thin a man's poor chest was, after all. It was as thin as paper, surrounding a hollow oval space of wind and bitterness. Thump, 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 thump. It would crash through at any minute, and what then? Do I greet it? Introduce myself? How long can a man sit holding his heart in his hands? Or was that thump coming from elsewhere? The thump of a bed. Were the missionaries making love? The male missionary making love to the female missionary? The courtship of missionaries. The male missionary, larger and more splendidly plumaged than his shy, dowdy mate, hurls his head back joyfully and sings, "Praise the Lord," upon which he rushes forth, tail feathers spread, and mounting in a decorous and even pious manner, inserts his tongue into her right ear. You are the lost tribe of Israel, and therefore you must pray especially hard, for the lost tribe of Israel is under God's everlasting curse. Do you understand? Why don't you answer me? What is the matter with you children? Do you wish to remain accursed? Now you answer me, Lewis Moon, or I'm going to beat you. Lewis. His body cavity felt hollowed out as if cold, sterile winds were blowing through it. Loss, 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 loss. Look into the sky and think of nothing, said Alvin Moon, Joe Red Cloud. But do not look into the sun, for the sun will blind you. Face east on the first day, south on the second, west on the third, north on the fourth, until you are at the center of the circle, and then you will know the power of the world. After the first day, his stomach hurt, and he felt foolish, all alone on a rock lookout above a river bend of box elder and cottonwood. All that night he shivered. He was not like the old men, nor even like his father. He spoke American and raised the American flag at school. He wore blue jeans and looked at magazines in stores and stood around outside the movie in the town, searching his pockets as if he had real money. And he did not believe in visions. Like all the children, he killed his hunger at the mission house on Sunday and afterward felt ashamed. Once he went hungry, telling the missionaries that Cheyennes never ate on Sundays. He remained on the rock a second day and a second night, just out of stubbornness, and because he was proud of the rifle that Alvin Moon had laid beside him. No bear nor cougar came. The animals would not bother him, his father said, if he sat still. And on the third morning, he did not feel hungry anymore and sat there motionless, letting the sun and wind blow through him. He was as firmly rooted in the ground as a young pine. By afternoon, he was growing weak and became filled with apprehension. Something was happening. The jays and squirrels had lost all fear of him, flicking over and about him as if he had turned to stone. And the shrill of insects crystallized in a huge ringing silence. The sky was ringing, and the pine trees on the rocks turned a bright, rigid green, each needle shimmering. The pines were ringing, and beside him a blue lupin opened, breathing. Then the river turned to silver and stopped flowing. The jays trembled on the rock, their eyes too bright, and the squirrel was still, the gold hairs flowing on its tail. He stared at the enormous sky, and the sky descended, and the earth was rising from below, and he was soaring toward the center. Then, in the ringing far away, rose a flat droning. The airplane unraveled the high silence as it crossed the sky. It disappeared without ever appearing, and when it had gone, the sky no longer rang. He sat a long time on his rock, but the sky had risen, leaving him desolate. Lightheaded, he went down to the river where he drank. He found mushrooms and freshwater mussels and some berries, and when he had eaten, he laughed at his three-day vigil, pretending that he did not feel a dreadful sorrow. On the fourth day, waiting for Alvin Moon to come, he hunted. He killed a wild goose on the river and boasted of it to his father. His father gazed at him. And where is the goose, his father said. I could not reach it, the boy said. It came so close and then drifted far away. He reeled from the bed and drifted to the window, but the figure coming down the street was gone. Again he had missed some unknown chance. The street was void, a void, a void. Dog, heat, a vulture, nothing more. A dog, a vulture, nothing more. And thus we parted, sang Lenore. Singing, somewhere, somewhere there was singing. His whole body shimmered with the chords, the fountainhead of music overflowing. You're sleeping your life away, he told the dog. Do you hear me? I said, do you hear me? Merriweather, the sheriff said. That's some name for a red nigger, ain't it? You're the smart one, ain't you, kid? Ain't you supposed to be the smart Cheyenne? Done good in the war, and now they're going to send their little pet Christ-loving Cheyenne to college. Ain't that right, kid? Well, kid, if you're a real smart engine, you won't even go look at me that way. You'll keep your engine nose clean, kid. Oh, to be an Indian, now that spring is here. Big Irma, be a good boy, Lewis. Don't fight so much. You come back and see us now. Alas, too late. The world is dead, you sleepyhead. The inn of the dog and the vulture. There are voices you see, and then singing voices, strange musics hollowed out as if drifted through a wind tunnel. These followed by a huge void of bleak silence suggesting death. The story of my life by Lewis Moon. Now, something has happened, was happening, is happening, but will not happen. Do you hear me? I said, do you hear me? softer tone, please. To begin at the beginning, my name is Meriwether Lewis Moon. Or is that the end? Again, I was named Meriwether Lewis Moon after Meriwether Lewis, who with Lieutenant William Clark crossed North America without killing a single Indian. So said my father. My father is Alvin Moon, Joe Red Cloud, who lived up on North Mountain. Alvin Moon still traps and hunts, and in World War I, when still a despised non-citizen, exempt from service, joined those 16,999 other Indians as insane as himself who volunteered to serve in World War I. Alvin Moon is half Cheyenne. He went down south when he came home and took up with a Creole Choctaw woman named Big Irma and brought her back up to his mountain. The worst mistake that Alvin Moon ever made was trying to educate himself. His information about Lewis and Clark was the only piece of education he ever obtained, and it was wrong. He used to joke that he couldn't educate himself unless he learned to read, and how could he learn to read if he didn't educate himself? So he left off hunting and trapping and came down off his mountain and took work near the reservation to keep his children in the mission school to give them a better chance in life. "I ain't got nothing," said Joe Red Cloud, "and I don't know nothing, not a thing. And the hell of it is, I broke my back, paid out every cent to keep them kids into that school, and now they don't know nothing neither, only Jesus Christ. Now ain't that something? They sit around here thinking about God Almighty, I guess, while they're waiting on their government reliefs." All but Meriwether Lewis. Again, my name is Lewis Moon, and I am lying on a bed, deathbed, in a strange country, and I hear eerie voices, and a crack is appearing on the wall, wider and wider, and the bulb in the ceiling is growing more and more bulbous, and will surely explode. A crack of doom, of lightning down the walls. "You listen to me, Meriwether Lewis. What the hell you sass that sheriff for? He might have killed you. You stay clear of whiskey, then. As long as you can't stay out of trouble, you ain't welcome back. And don't show your man that bad face, neither. I whupped you plenty of times before, and I'll whup you again. Hero or no hero," Alvin Moon, Joe Red Cloud said. "You're all your people have got left to count on. You go get that education, hear me now? And then you come on home and learn it back to us as best you can. Because the way things are going here, there ain't no hope for none of us, lest we don't get something learned here to us pretty quick." I've opened my eyes again to shut off all that blue. Color can threaten, overwhelm whirling like that. An ant in a kaleidoscope might sense the problem. But out here, the bed shudders, the chair sneaks, the bureau budges. They back and fill. "Plenty of times before, and I'll up you again. Hero or no hero," Alvin Moon, Joe Red Cloud said. "You're all your people have got left to count on. You go get that education, hear me now? And then you come on home and learn it back to us as best you can. Because the way things are going here, there ain't no hope for none of us, lest we don't get something learned here to us pretty quick." I've opened my eyes again to shut off all that blue. Color can threaten, overwhelm, whirling like that. An ant in a kaleidoscope might sense the problem. But out here, the bed shudders, the chair sneaks, the bureau budges. They back and fill, about to charge. From above, the bulb socket descends like a falling spider, leaving the bulb behind. I'm cut off. I feel both silly and depressed. It is the solitude, not solitude, but isolation. Death is the final isolation. But from what? From what? I'm trying to reach out to you. I do not know who you are. I cannot see you. I only feel your presence in this room. Perhaps, I wonder, are you inside me? And if so, now listen carefully. There's a lost reality, a reality lost long ago. Are you in touch with it? Can you tell me? Did you see? Or are you the figure in the center of the street? So you came here after all. Can you hear me? I said, can you hear me? He felt like crying, but did not. He had not cried in 20 years, no more. Had he ever cried? Yet he did not really feel like crying. He felt like laughing, but did not. Stalking Joe Red Cloud's shack as twilight came, he waited to be called back, beaten and forgiven. But with the clear prairie darkness came the knowledge that the call would never come, that the days of tears and comfort had come and gone before he had realized they would ever end. Dry-eyed, enraged, he crouched in the sagebrush for a little while, and then moved off like a lean, yearling grizzly driven snarling from the cave, feeling very bad and very good at the same time, and spoiling for a fight. He crouched beside the window sill, his back to the world without, and far away he heard them coming, the marching of huge, nameless armies coming toward him, And once again his hands turned cold. He felt very cold. On the wall of the room over the door, he saw a huge moth with a large white spot on each wing. It palpitated gently. He could hear the palpitations, and the spots were growing. The dark was rolling from the forest all around, and the sky was so wild as the sunset that it hurt his eyes. He reeled and fell, then thrashed to his feet and fell again across the bed, and was sucked down into the darkness as the music burst the walls and overwhelmed him. Snow, dawn, black aspens. The creature rose at the boy's coming and somersaulted backward, whining and snarling, the trap clatter muffled in white silences. Whiteness, the blood pools colored black, the tight zone cold. A great head and yellow eyes too big for coyote, the last wolf in the mountains, the first and only wolf the boy had ever seen. He had no rifle. The old wolf leapt to drive him back and fell forward on its muzzle, which rose white-tipped from the snow. Its tongue fell out. The icy steel worked tighter on its foreleg, and the pain confused it, for it looked aside and wagged its tail a little, shivering. Then just once it howled a real wolf howl, pure as the black air of the mountain forest. Then it lay down. It had been gnawing on its foreleg, just above where the trap had snapped, and now it began again, whining and snarling at its own agony and the stubbornness of its own bone which held it earthbound. The mad yellow eyes watched him, the taut muzzle, the purplish curled gum, red teeth, the jaw. The scrape of teeth on living bone made him cry out. The ears flicked forward, but the gnawing did not stop. When he came close, it sprang sideways. Another such spring might free it. He drew back, frightened of the mad wild yellow eyes. The sun rose to low banks of winter clouds. The day grew cold. He cut a sapling and carved a spear point, long and white. Confronting the wolf, he drove the raw white wood into its chest as it came up at him, and fought to pin it to the ground and grind the pain out of it. But still it fought to live, dull heavy thumps in the white flying powder. A blood fleck seared his lip. The wolf was snapping the place where the stake pierced it. Shaken free, he had fallen within reach of it, but the stunned creature only raised its bleeding teeth from its own wounds and stared at him and past him, blinked once at the dying winter world in days, and lay its head upon its forepaws, panting. This is a proud day for the mission, Lewis, and a proud day for your people. We all count on you. He struggled to free himself, but the stake held in his heart, the hole in his heart. Even breathing hurt him, even breathing. He clawed at his own chest to ease it. If only he could get that pain out, then his heart would bleed his life away, but gently. With the music rising in the summer breeze, there came a gay, preposterous parade along the high road, calliope flutings and fanfare, with bandwagons and floats and maelstroms of confetti, powder pigeons and emerald parakeets, bursting drums and golden tubas, and gauzy, fat-cheeked majorettes in crotch-tight sateen suits, chins bouncing on high, squeaking breasts like taut balloons, and an immense, blousy one-man band of a hand-me-down Big Irma, beer-soaked and high-colored, all billowing bows and curlicues and furbelows, a few in texture. Look at her go! Hurrah! Hurrah! All leer and wink, hiking her skirts to turn the ankle, pretty still, beneath the mass of tired flesh, and trying in vain to shake a ball of hair and dog turd from her heel, squinching and squashing and squirting along like a banquet dumped into a bag. She wore a gigantesque plumed hat which she flew like a flag, and as the old tub pushed along, batting her eyes and swinging her butt, she leaked and sagged and oozed so woefully at the seams that rats and crows fought for her leavings, while in the front and alongside, as trumpets blew and pennants flew and children snickered and horses nickered, stores and provisions and water and fuel were crammed aboard. Varlets hurled up trays of tarts and heaved up meats and slung up wine flagons and kegs of ale, while others ran to pump in gasoline and air, barely able to offset the waste and loss of the vast outpourings beneath. Big Irma, meanwhile, nothing daunted, leering and winking to beat hell, and curtsying prettily as the bands played and hats were tossed and wild cheers rent the air, hip, hip, peru, and winking her blinkers and twinking her pinky and twirling a tiny parasol, all giggling and goosed and poked as if to say, well, sweet Christ knows I always done my damnedest. Once upon a time at morning, a small blood-silver river in the rising plains, the silver undersides of wind-awakened leaves, the silver spider webs and dew. A small boy hunting, poised, quick, listening, in a fine old-smelling boat parting new reeds. soft drops falling from an oar, a newborn sun far bugling, a swan. The stalk, the shot, the yellow blackbirds, the white bird turning a slow circle, head underwater. Feathers floating in wild silence. That morning his skin tingled, and he laughed aloud in that sky-high aloneness that was not loneliness, the strength of a young animal among animals in a soft summer sunrise. Horses, rodeos, long murky bars, and rotten sawdust smell in high small sandy towns of the Great Basin, a coyote trapped by hurtling cars with a road cut through the rock, a lone whiskey bottle on the shoulder of the road. Night voices, speed, a dirtied strength, a flight, a maiming, a lost friend. Women and bystanders overrun, struck aside by wheels spun loose from flying axles, flying hooves by fenders. Highways, sirens, howling lights, a crash, dread silence, smoke, and twisted metal shards, flayed twisted limbs, a staring eye, and gasoline spreading like a stain of blood on the stunned pavement. Hiss of steam, oncoming sirens, sirens, meow. Down the road. The big two-tone auto stank of lotion and cigar butts, but it moved. It roared across the land like an apocalypse, almost to the state line, before the oil gauge flashed red. Then he forced it harder still, grinding his teeth and driving the gas through it to burn it clean, until the tires reeked and the body shuddered, until the fat plastic dashboard bulged with warnings, until the whole fat contraption of church-going chromium and patriotic plush screeched and choked on its own heat and burst its block and screamed to a hissing, locked, fiery halt with 8 million all-American motorcycles hard behind. Yeah. A last swig and he broke the bottle and toppled out, rolling and laughing on the highway shoulder. Down he went through waving weeds into the swamp, hailing and cursing the cop silhouettes, with $2,000 and a hand cut by broken teeth, and nothing and nowhere but free by Christ, how free of their whole Indian game. He headed eastward to New York. On a truck radio he heard the charges, grand larceny, an automobile and $2,000, and felonious assault. See, Lewis, it ain't gonna work, man. You find yourself another local. I don't get it. You had a fight in here yourself only last week. You guys were drunk right on the job. You don't fight the way we fight. We fight for fun, Lewis. Because we like it. Because we like it. We ain't trying to prove nothing. So you just find yourself a nice white local where they fight the way you fight. White local? There's more Cheyenne in this blood coming out of my nose than there is Mohawk and all you bastards put together. You got shit in your blood, too. We never heard of Cheyennes hardly until you come along. Anyway, we ain't professional Indians like you. All we know about Indians bub is what we've seen on television. Sirens, howling lights, another crash, another, still another, modern times. Crash, crash, crash. That crazy kid is crazy. He began to laugh. The crashes became gimcrack destruction, a breaking and tinkling of deafening dimensions, a mounting heap of slow jalopies hurling themselves together at a crossroads. Port scene with rum, tropical colors, high white birds, the lonely palms of dawn, a crazy-legged negress dancing nude, wisteria, her flesh. Because the way things are going, there ain't no hope for none of us, lest we don't get something learned here to us pretty quick. Lucidity, he sighed. He lay there all laughed out and loose, loose as a dead snake slung on a rail, lay there drunk with gentleness and pleasure. Be a good boy, Lewis. Do not hate so much. But this time, even as he laughed, an apprehension came. He crawled to the corner of the room where he crouched low, watching both door and window. The noises were surrounding him. There was something happening to him, something happening, and he felt too tired now to deal with it. If he could only stop this laughing. But he could not. His laughter grew louder and louder, and when he tried to stop, he could not close his mouth. It stretched wider and wider until he swallowed the ceiling light, the room, the window, and the night. The world rushed down into the cavernous void inside him, leaving him alone in space, pinwheeling wildly like a jagged fragment spun out from the planet. A terrific wind blew, and his ears rang with the bells of blue-black space. The wind sealed his throat, his flesh turned cold, his screams were but squeaks, snapped out and away by the passage of night's fears. Nor could he hear, there was no one to hear, there was no one where he had gone. What's happening? What is happening? He had flung himself away from life, from the very last realities, had strayed to the cold, windy reaches of insanity. This perception was so clear and final that he moaned he would not find his way back. You've gone too far this time. You've gone too far. As he whirled into oblivion, his body cooled and became numb, inert, like a log seized up and borne out skyward by a cyclone. He struggled to reach out, catch hold, grasp, grip, hang on, but he could not. He could not. He was made of wood, and there was nothing to hang on to, not even his own thought. Thought shredding, drifting out of reach like blowing spider webs. He was gone, 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 and around again. The howling was in his head, and all about lay depthless silence. His screaming was ripped away before it had left his mouth, and the mouth itself was far away, a huge papered hoop blown through and tattered by the gales. The air rushed past too fast to breathe. His lungs sucked tight, shriveled like prunes, collapsed. He died. Death came as a huge bounteous quiet in the bosom of a high white cloud. The wood of his body softened, the knots loosened. He opened up, lay back, exhausted, mouth slack, eyes wide like the bald eyes of a corpse. He glimpsed a hard, light, lucid region of his mind like a lone comet wandering far out across the long night of the universe. I'd be very happy to answer any questions about those things I read or anything else that might occur to you. So,
how did you decide to write about the Indians? Obviously, you did play your role in early work, but your new book is about Indians.
My very first book, too, has an Indian guy who's sort of run over and trampled by the situation in New England where he is. So it's a long time kind of preoccupation. I think it's an underlying preoccupation of all of us in this country, really. That this we talk a lot about Vietnam now and our uneasiness about that war, and that's been debated, as we all know, many times and back and forth. But I think that in part that's kind of not a cover for our preoccupation about Indian people. I think that this really is, for those of us who feel strongly about this country, who feel and realize what a great country it is and could be, cannot live with our treatment of the Indian people, really. I think it's a kind of ongoing guilt and dread that we have, and that they, anyway, in my life I've always been bothered by it and preoccupied with it, and I think it really began that way, and it keeps popping up in more than half my books, really. There is some thing having to do with Indians, really. It's not just recent at all.
Is there any positive acceptance of spirit of
creative
work in the state of South Dakota, or was it all?
Oh, yeah. Sure. There was. There are a lot of people there that aren't crazy about Governor Jankbo, and those people liked it a lot. At least up to the time he sued. I don't want to be funny here. I think the feeling among Indian people was very mixed. It kind of depended where your head was, and I've had a lot of wonderful letters and response from there, and also some negative response. I think most of the white people in South Dakota are pretty suspicious of that book, unless they had a personal dislike for some of the FBI agents or the governor or some of the other people involved. I don't know. Now at least they're reading it, though, thanks to the fact that I'm being sued up there by the governor. a lot of people are kind of picking it up and reading it, and there's quite a lot of editorial discussion. In fact, it's the biggest news story in South Dakota in the past year. Been a lot of attention to it. As I said to somebody today, my sales went up from 3 to 30 because of the statewide, you know. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but. How extensive? Can you hear me if I get away from this? not very extensive. I had an assignment to go there, and I went down there for the New Yorker magazine, and I was fascinated by it, and I've been there, and I've since returned once or twice for short periods. I was there for several months, I guess. I began by taking a freighter up the Amazon from Belém all the way up to Iquitos, which is about 1,800 miles up the Amazon. So it's a good, slow, relaxed way to see the Amazon. And then I got hung up on it, that whole area, and I heard about this fantastic fossil jawbone that had been discovered there, and was out in the jungle, and got a couple of people together, and we actually went in canoes and found the damn thing. It turned out to be a fossil. I took pictures of it to the American Museum of Natural History, and they said that it was a fossil crocodilian, unknown to science. It was and not less than 50 feet long. That's quite a crocodile. And unfortunately, we lugged this damn jaw, it was petrified, a huge stone, and practically sank the canoe. And we lugged it down the river, it's really, I guess, hundreds of miles, only to have the Peruvian authorities confiscate it at the last minute before we got it over the Andes. And unfortunately, nobody down there is really qualified to analyze it. So it's, as far as I know, it still sits in the police yard in Pucallpa, Peru. If any of you ever go to Pucallpa, please see if it's still there. Well, if I get obsessed, I work all day long. I don't really impose anything, except a sort of neurotic compulsion, you know. But I usually work in mornings, and if things are going well, I'll work into the early afternoon. And generally speaking, writing about 5 hours a day, I guess, and then I do research and reading and try to pull it all together.